Hi, everyone. We're recording this, so people, I know it's a busy week, the first week of classes, and so we wanted to provide this as a recorded resource for others to have access to later. But I think we have critical mass. We'll get started here. And now screen sharing fails to start. That's okay. There we go. All right. I think everyone can hear and see me. And if you haven't already, please take a minute to update or to open a web browser or get your smartphone ready to respond to Poll Everywhere, which we'll be using later, if Chris wouldn't mind pasting that into the chat. So hello and welcome to this panel and community discussion about research and experiential learning opportunities for undergraduates in the Department of Earth and Space Sciences. And today's chat is being organized by the ESS Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee in collaboration with lots of members of our ESS community and friends. And at various times, we may stop sharing slides for a moment so we can look at each other, but just to keep it simple and streamlined, I'll keep showing the slides, but you can change your own view in Zoom to look at faces and have a display that feels good to you. So my name is Kate Huntington, and I'm a professor in ESS and chair of the DEI committee, and my pronouns are she and her. And before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge that this is a virtual meeting at the University of Washington, which is built on the land of the Coast Salish peoples. And so our other facilitators today are going to be Andy Schauer and Chris Wren from the DEI committee. And we'll be sharing the link to a survey at the end for you to share additional questions if we run out of time. And I'll also take this opportunity just to mention that students and actually all members of the ESS community can submit their ideas and comments and concerns about this topic of this session or anything relating to diversity and inclusion in ESS in a few different ways. And let's see, looking at the slide here, the bottom right, one way is to email the student advocates via the ESS advising email at the bottom of the slide. You can also email the chair of the department, but to augment sort of these traditional avenues, we created the ESS electronic comments box. And just to explain this, and the link is there on the bottom right as well. This is an anonymous online survey. You can enter your name if you want, but our director of student services checks this regularly, and she and the DEI committee chair, which is me right now, work together to try to respond. And so the names and the emails of other DEI committee members are also listed on that link to the comments box. And our committee has undergrads, grads, postdocs, staff, faculty. And so there's a wide range of people there, and you're invited to reach out to any of us individually as well to see whoever you feel most comfortable with. And just to let you know, the two main ways we address concerns that we get through this avenue is, number one, by raising the issues with people around the university who are in a position of power and responsibility to help, because our committee really doesn't have access to a lot of things that may be asked for. And two, by doing what our committee can do, and that is developing policies and community events like this one aimed at addressing core issues with systemic change. But often, just so you know, we need more information to take action, and we don't have a really good way yet to communicate what actions are being taken, especially when the comments are anonymous. And so to make this better, just a heads up, we'll be working to formalize the process of submitting comments and addressing them and post whatever that final process is on the department website in a clearer way in the coming months. And so suggestions are welcome. So on to today's event. The purpose of this discussion is to raise awareness of the extracurricular opportunities available to ESS undergrad students, and also to recognize the unspoken culture that leads to barriers and accessibility gaps to these opportunities. And so our target audience is really divided into two groups. One, our undergrads, and the second, anyone who could serve as a mentor. And so students, in addition to demystifying the process a bit, we hope you take away from our discussion today the message that you absolutely deserve to be here, and we encourage you to try out research, lab, and/or field experiences that can benefit you. And faculty, grad students, postdocs, and staff who have these opportunities to offer, The reality is business as usual does present barriers to many. And so we want to be intentional about how undergrads are recruited and mentored in our department to remove those barriers to access and make our undergrad opportunities really equitable. And so we'll give you practical tips on how to get started. And so we think both groups are going to love to hear directly from our wonderful student panelists. And so to help us have an authentic conversation while taking care of ourselves and each other, and to negotiate power relations, since there's a range of people in our group today, we're going to follow some norms for the discussion. We want all voices to be heard, so please listen attentively, participate as you feel able, and share the space. Acknowledge power dynamics and that people like me, who are faculty and white people and somebody who's senior and in a position of relative power, I'm going to try to listen and amplify the voices of others. Please focus on ideas, no directed personal comments. Engage with curiosity, seek to understand perspectives, yet don't ask individuals to speak for a group. And depending on what comes up, ouch and educate is the rule of thumb. Please speak up if you feel uncomfortable about any comments and help others see your perspective. And in general, just this is about being kind to yourself and others. So the last logistical piece is how the chat and discussion will work. You don't have to memorize this. You can follow along with those slides that are linked in the chat. And we'll also share the materials after. So if you'd like to have a comment or ask a question, please use the group chat and follow these instructions. You can just type stack into the chat if you want to be called on, or type your question. And Chris Wren will call on people because I can't see the chat. And you can also send anonymous comments, and we'll use poll everywhere. So we'll start with that right now. Let's see if we can, did people already respond? Or is this do I clear the
room? No, it works. Yay, it's working.
It works? Oh gosh, okay, great. So we have a range of people joining us today, which is exactly what we wanted. So welcome everyone. And now I'm gonna hand it over to Andy Schauer, our ESS staff member and lab manager of Isolab, who'll explain the format and introduce our first panelist. So Andy, do you wanna take over sharing screen, or do you want me to keep showing?
Okay, maybe you could turn screen sharing off. Okay.
We practice this, I promise.
Yes. Okay, thank you, Kate. We're gonna hear from several panelists right now to go over what opportunities exist in ESS and how we might obtain those opportunities. And so we're going to go through a series of little presentations from people that might be mentors in our department. And we're going to limit you to 2 minutes so that we can get through to the end and have an actual discussion. And I'm going to have a little timer that I hope isn't too annoying, but if you hear the timer go off, that means it's 2 minutes is up. Let's see, I think that covers everything. If you do not want screen sharing on, or you do want it on, please just make that known and we'll take care of that for you. I guess Kate will, or yeah. Okay, so our first is Drew Gorman-Lewis, a professor in ESS. Take it away, Drew.
Okay, so I guess the slides are not being shared. That's okay if they're
not. I'm sharing them now.
Either way is okay. So I just wanted to take a quick couple of minutes to talk about opportunities that exist. And, you know, when you hear undergraduate opportunities, probably the first thing you think is undergraduate research. And, you know, traditionally something like field work or lab work. And while those opportunities exist, we'll hear more about them from other folks. I would encourage you to think much more broadly about what undergraduate research can be. So, you know, maybe if you're interested in something like library science or data management, there could be opportunities to do that within sort of undergraduate research. And even, you know, if there are artistic folks out there. So in terms of art and graphic design, I've always said that, you know, science needs artists because so much of what we do is about communicating our science. And visuals are an integral part of that communication. So, you know, maybe art is just a hobby, but maybe that's a hobby that you could apply to an undergraduate research project. So think broadly about that. And that goes out to faculty as well. We tend to get sort of locked into these ideas. Well, I have this project or I have that project and that's all I have. So, you know, think about what you need because undergraduates could be a really vital resource. So in addition to kind of those traditional ideas about undergraduate research, there are other opportunities to get involved in the department through serving on committees. There are college committees. And in fact, I think just today, an email went out from the college looking for new student ambassadors. So, you know, you think broadly about getting involved because it's, you know, beyond just our department, there are opportunities in the college as well. And, you know, if you're maybe interested in work study, there are opportunities in our department office. If you're interested in teaching, we've got our seminar in earth science education, which would provide some hands-on opportunities to teach. If you're into getting out and going on field trips, you know, think about Geo Club. And if outreach is of interest to you, then, you know, get connected with our Rocking Out. So, you know, if you're looking for opportunities, they are out there. We are here to help you find those opportunities, but I would encourage you to think broadly about what they may be and encourage faculty to think broadly about how they can incorporate undergrads.
Thanks, Drew. That was awesome. Next, we're going to hear from Joel Gombiner, who's a graduate student in ESS. Take it away, Joel.
All right. Thanks, Andy. Thanks, Drew. I'm also one of the coordinators for Rockin' Out, which is our K through 12 outreach program. But I'm just going to tell you a little bit today about sort of four different ways you can get into the field in earth and space sciences. The first one, which probably many of you have already done, is taking an ESS class that has field trips or field components associated with it. And I've listed at least some of the classes that have day trips or weekend trips. And then a sort of bigger field experience is ESS 400 or 401, which is field geology. Obviously during, Juliet said that is only a partial list. Okay, that's true. Yeah, I went through the course catalog and saw which ones had the world field trip in the course description. This year during the pandemic, I would recommend reaching out to the instructors before you sign up for the class with the expectation of going to the field and find out what their plans are to do or not do those field trips. So aside from ESS classes, Drew mentioned that Geo Club often leads field trips. They'll go out on the weekends or sometimes over spring break for a bigger field experience. And Rockin' Out, our outreach organization, we're planning to start doing walks in Seattle parks as another way to get out into the field. Drew also mentioned that doing research is a great way to gain lab experience or field experience. And you can either do a research project with an existing research group and kind of hop on to something that has a field experience associated with it. Or you can, as Drew said, kind of take matters into your own hands and start designing your own research project with a field component. So that's a great way. And I've included a couple links there if you go into the slide deck for how to see more about how to do that. And then the final thing I wanted to mention is that you can go outside of the ESS department for field opportunities. There's a lot of great groups and societies in Washington that may offer weekend field trips. And there's also enthusiast groups on Facebook that'll talk about cool places to look at rocks and geology in the state of Washington. So I included four there, the Ice Age Floods Institute, which does have some chapters in Western Washington, Cascade Mineralogical Society, Washington Rockhounds, a group on Facebook, and then the Geological Society of America often offers many field trips associated with their meetings. So that's, and then Kathy has dropped in the chat, Northwest Geological Society, and AEG as well. So four different ways to think about getting yourself out into the field. That's all I have.
Thanks, Joel. That was great. Next, we're going to hear from Mickey Kassar, who's an engineer in the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network.
Thanks, Andy. So as Andy mentioned, my name's Mickey Kassar. I'm a field engineer with the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network. So the PNSN is a regional seismic network tasked with monitoring earthquakes and volcanoes across the states of Washington and Oregon. We operate an array of electronic equipment and associated servers and processes to detect and locate earthquakes. Our mission is essentially to monitor seismic and volcanic hazards and mitigate their impacts on our communities. For example, you may have heard of the Earthquake Early Warning System Shake Alert. All of the data used to develop earthquake early warning alerts in Washington and Oregon are generated by the PNSN. And a lot of work goes into this effort, which means we frequently have opportunities for students. So I've catered my slide to illustrate the types of opportunities we offer and the resulting experiences that are gained when working on our projects, as well as existing skills that you may already have and can utilize on our projects. So the photos on my slides also show work being done by current and former students, student employees on one seismic station across two summers. So I pointed this out to illustrate that we simultaneously employ a number of students and we like to keep them on for long periods of time. This increases the benefits that they have on our network as they gain experience, and it increases the range of skills they are able to develop over their tenure here. So the main takeaway of this is that working with the PNSN can significantly increase your employment opportunities as you move forward in your time at UW. For example, one of these students used the programming skills he honed at PNSN to land a full-time permanent position at Microsoft. One of them currently directs our social media accounts. One student is in the message program, and one is now a permanent full-time employee at PNSN. And just a quick heads up for the future, we'll be looking for two new students to work on some CompSci and research projects this spring. And I hope this discussion presents some new ways for us to advertise in order to reach a broader range of students.
Thanks, Mickey. That was great. If any of you have toured the indoor facility downstairs in the PNSN, it's a wonderful facility down there. But most of it happens in the field, of course. Let's see, next we're gonna hear from Kathy Troost, but before we do that, we want to do another poll where we're gonna try to get a feel for what you think you wanna do after you graduate. So this is of course geared towards undergraduate students at the moment.
If I could just say, when we were testing out the polls, I think Andy and I were both like, oh, we every time we're like, this is great, we want to travel. This pandemic, yeah. My gosh. Looks like we got some responses here, Andy.
Yeah, great. Okay, so I think the take a break may be a little biased because of our testing yesterday, but still it's a worthy effort to do when you're done with a undergraduate degree. Lots of getting jobs, some traveling, and graduate school, of course. Nobody wants to go back to undergrad. Yeah, that's understandable. You've just finished your degree. Okay, next is Kathy Troost, and take it away, Kathy.
Thanks, Andy. Hello, everybody. So why, it was great to see that poll, and I'll get to that in a minute, but why should you consider these extracurricular activities that we've all been talking about? And I think because, first of all, they're fun, they're very enriching, but for those of you who really are focused on getting a job as soon as you graduate, they will help you get a job to start building your career. And you will find that the job market, either petroleum, private industry, government, academia, resources, it's all a very competitive job market. Outside of petroleum, 80% of you are going to end up in private industry, meaning environmental geology or geotechnical consulting, engineering geology. For every entry-level job in our region that's posted in the private industry, there are about 200 applicants. So that's what I mean when I say that it's very competitive. So I have a few tips for you for improving your chances of getting hired. Let's whittle that down from 200 to one. Most importantly, network, network, network. You need to start steps toward getting a license. In most of the states in the country, you have to have a license to practice geology. You need to always be sure that you tailor your resume and cover letter to job postings. In other words, use keywords. Ask for informational interviews. That's part of your networking. And I've learned that the top three traits that employers are looking for is that you are a good communicator, that you're engaging and energetic, and that you can be flexible. And then the skills that most employers are looking for are mad tech skills, good math skills, GIS, and then do you have something unique to offer? Also, it helps to have taken courses in applied geosciences and honestly getting a graduate degree. But most importantly, back to the topic of today, and that is getting experience. Get out in the field as much as you can. Work in a lab, do research, do presentations, volunteer with professional associations. All of those things will help you get some experience so that you can be more competitive. So good luck.
Thanks, Kathy. Next, we're going to hear from Fengchen Tang, who's a faculty in ESS.
Hey, can you guys hear me? Okay, so you can hear me, right?
Yes, yes, oh. I can hear you.
Okay, so I'm Fengchen Tang. I'm a professor in ESS. So today I will talk about my own experience on how to hire students to work in my lab. So over the past 8 years, I have about 18 students working in my lab. I just checked them, about 2/3 of them are from my classes, either geochemistry class or igneous petrology class. So the students in this class, they talk to me about their desire to work in my lab. And at the end of the quarter, I always announce the opportunities for them to work in my lab if they are interested. So apparently this is the most important way for me to get students working in the lab. Besides this, sometimes I have a project, I really need someone to help in the lab immediately. I will ask the ESS advising to send out emails to all the majors in ESS and to see if they are interested to work in my lab. I got a couple of students working in the lab in this way. And sometimes I also got random emails from the students from ESS. So they ask about lab opportunities. So I always try my best to accommodate their request. But if I just hired some students already, then I cannot. So these are the major ways I hire students to work in the lab. And I also actually hired 2 students in different ways. Both of them are outside of our department. Because I want to design a website. So I post the ad on work studies, and also I send emails to the computer science department. So they spread my words, then eventually I hired 2 students. So these are major ways I got students working in my lab. I think if you are interested in working a lab, and the take-home message basically is, you should contact the professor you are interested in directly. You can do that like after class, emails, by calls. I feel like if you can do this first step, the most important step, you have a really high chance to get an opportunity to work in your lab. That's my own experience. So that's it.
Thanks, Fengchen. That's great. I think Kate, you're gonna take over now. Is that right?
Yep. And thank you all for these perspectives. And, you know, there's a lot of excitement about what the opportunities are and how they can benefit you. I mean, look at all the people that Kathy has hired as a business owner and connected with other jobs and internships across the state. Are we in the hundreds or thousands, Kathy? She'll answer that later. You know, that sounds both exciting and really daunting to hear that, you know, a lot of the times this happens kind of serendipitously, and it's on the student to reach out. And so just to let you know that a lot of what we try to prepare you for in ESS 418, the Geoscience Communication course, is about preparing you to feel like you can reach out with confidence. And so we can do things like package those materials and make them available to students even before they take that class so that you can reach out with confidence in a professional way. So next, I want to share a screen again here. What I'd like to do, see if this will work, is realizing that often it comes down to serendipity, how people advertise these opportunities and how students do or don't find them. And those are obviously our test questions. Okay. It's serendipitous about how people might find out about these opportunities. So what we'd like to do to help us start changing that serendipity or whether you do or do not find them, we'd like to know from you how you students prefer ESS to contact you about opportunities. So can you see this poll? Okay, so you can respond in poll everywhere or just type it into the chat or yell it out if you have particular ways that you like us to contact you. Because right now, basically, people who have opportunities forward an email to advising. Is that enough? Okay. I'm not seeing answers in the I'm not seeing answers appear in the poll, so I feel free to answer them in the chat or just tell us afterwards, because we would love to hear, like, what are the ways? Is it a Facebook page? Is it email blasts? Or do you get 1,000 emails and that's useless? What sorts of ways do you want to hear about these opportunities?
Can I point out that it would be helpful to know what kind of listservs the students might be on as well? Because oftentimes we send things to listservs, and the more students that see it, the better.
And I have questions about social media. Like, is Instagram a thing that's useful? Should the department put more effort into maintaining that? Or are Twitter feeds going to be good? Or is there something else that we should be really thinking about?
Okay, now I'm seeing the answers start, and they're all email. So maybe we're not the worst that we're already doing. Undergrad research database email, but the auto email thing every day has so much text, sometimes things get overlooked. And by that, it's the department's like daily, this is what's happening thing. Email. All right, then I guess we're not as terribly off base as we thought we were. Have people make announcements in class would be a great way to comment or compliment that. Okay, now we're getting to the part, Twitter and listserv. Other comments? Sorry, I'll be quiet.
Yeah, we do have a few more comments here. So Instagram is good, LinkedIn, and Owen also posted Yes Underscore Jobs and Geotectonics.
Those are great. And we've also got coming up here, mentioning in classes, Instagram, on the course syllabus, lecture announcements, centralized website. Okay, so it's okay if all of your ideas haven't yet been talked about. We still have ways to, the point is we're starting to, we want to ask more systematically to find out what are the best ways to contact you. And I'm also showing you this next. We also sort of took a step to ask the faculty to talk about opportunities a little bit more organized way instead of one-offs and like 17 emails that go around, or maybe you mention it in class or not. And already we just got, just in the past week or two, we got a sample of ESS mentors that currently right now have opportunities for students. And we'll be sharing this list, but please, these are people who we asked, hey, we're doing this event. do you have opportunities? Do you want undergrads to contact you? And they said, yes, please post my contact information. And so although it feels like it might be a hard ask to send an email of introduction here, we do have examples for how do you write a professional email that we can share with you. So please contact me for those examples that we can post, or maybe we'll send them out to advising if you'd like that. And these are mentors who are waiting for your messages right now. Okay. So now I think we'd like to focus really on the student voices. And so we've asked a whole bunch of different panelists who volunteered from our current students, past students and alumni. And we've asked each of them to speak for about a couple minutes about their experience and share what they hope the students and the prospective mentors here need to hear. And so our first panelist is Gabby Alumpai, an ESS undergrad alum and current graduate student in the MESSAGE program that we've mentioned a few times here, but that's the Master's in Earth and Space Sciences Applied Geosciences program. And Gabby's also a member of the DEI committee who helped conceive of this event. So go for it, Gabby.
Thanks, Kate. As Kate mentioned, I'm a current MESSAGE student, but I graduated from Earth and Space Sciences in 2019 with a focus in geology. And at first, I just was curious about research and if I would like to do research. So I literally Googled undergraduate research at the University of Washington. And what popped up was the undergraduate research program database. And you can filter out some things in there, but the only opportunity that was on there for undergrads related to Earth and Space Science was at the Stromberg Lab, which was looking at phyllis. And so I applied for that and I was there for maybe about 3 months as a research assistant. And I realized that I wasn't passionate about phyllis, so I ended up leaving. And then I decided to try something new and go into the ESS website and see who is doing research that I would be interested in. And I found that Allison Duvall does research with subduction zones and how surface processes are related to that. And I became their research assistant for a while. And eventually I wanted to do my own research project during my senior year and decided that I would do a project on marine terraces in Haida Gwaii, Canada. So I mapped marine terraces and looked into that. What I didn't realize was that this research would lead me to my next two jobs. So after undergrad, I was hired on as an intern by the Port of Tacoma to create and manage a subsurface explorations database. And then right after that, I got my current job at the Department of Ecology. And one of the projects is to map historical shorelines and find erosion rates from that. So my three main takeaways from my story is that if you're going to be a senior, it's not too late to start a project. I started in the middle of my senior, in the fall quarter of my senior year, but it depends on the scope of your project as well. And you can even start later than that probably if you don't want to present at a symposium or the ESS Gala. Second, opportunities are not always posted. And for me, it was very uncomfortable to ask, especially because the field of geology is not very diverse, but asking will never hurt. And the third takeaway that I have is research does not necessarily mean you will end up in academia research. It can also lead you to applied geoscience jobs. That's all I have.
Thanks so much, Gabby, for sharing both the benefits and the unexpected things, but also for highlighting some of the challenges and how difficult it can be to reach out and have this all the ball be in your own court, especially in a field where not necessarily you have mentors who look like you. And so next we'd like to hear from our current ESS undergraduate and member of the ESS DEI committee, Edgar Santos Aguilar.
Good afternoon, everyone. As you know, my name is Edgar Santos Aguilar. I'm currently an undergrad, a fifth year within ESS and with a focus on the physics route. And so a little bit about my experience within my undergraduate opportunities. I honestly started off with, understanding what is it that I wanted to do in the long term. And I thought, you know, generally speaking, I wanted to become an engineer. And, you know, I went out of my way to find out that work study is a major, I would call it a great opportunity to find ways to find research opportunities. And so going out of your way to go through the UW Financial Aid Work Study website and looking through, you know, what opportunities there are, you'll find opportunities that may relate to your interests. And so, you know, it's kind of difficult at first because it's a completely new world. And also you're reaching out to complete strangers. However, what I've learned is that at the end of the day, you know, these are normal, these are human beings who are just, you know, want to look for people who, you know, have a great skill set. And that's how I obtained my first research opportunity with PAMPLAB within the psychiatry and behavioral department. I felt like it was a great opportunity and I want to keep moving forward to proceed to my next step in life, which is, you know, obtain my first internship. And being able to do so, I made sure that I leveraged my skill set from my involvement with extracurriculars, such as with the Society of Hispanic Professional Engineers, where I developed my professional development, learned how to network, and I obtained my first internship as a manufacturing engineer. And, you know, it is scary at first. I'm not going to say that it's easy, but, you know, I feel like being resilient to and being able to persevere to obtain your opportunities is highly doable. It's just mainly putting in the effort. And also I understand how much it is a letdown when opportunities show that, oh yeah, we're looking with someone who has this certain skill sets or have this amount of experience. You know, at the end of the day, I feel like giving it a try and showing them who you are as a person, as well as demonstrating that you're able to put in the effort to do a great job. I feel like that's one of the main things that's important for candidates to be able, you know, to work well. And I believe that those aspects is what people who are hiring should look into rather than their experience. You know, I feel like a lot of people have a lot of great potential that they can bring out and show them to everyone. And so because of that, I've gotten an internship as an industrial engineer. And overall, I've learned that the worst one can say is no. And if opportunity closes, another will open. And just make sure to continuously network. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Edgar. These are fabulous points to make. And some of the things I want to highlight is your idea of networking. You know, many people think that networking is a dirty word, like it means you're schmoozing around or pretending to be all, or I don't know, you know, just like posing or something. Networking is about your curiosity and figuring out what you want to do, and also your curiosity about other people and learning about them. It's about the human connection. And so it's scary, but I want to emphasize that it doesn't have to be scary. Just think of it in terms of like, I want to figure out what I'm curious about, and I want to learn about other people. And I think that if you do that, it takes a lot of the pressure off, like networking. I have to collect all these people in my, you know, in my LinkedIn account or something like that. So, and also the idea that you don't have to be, you know, those skills. One of the best things, at least if I can speak from my perspective, is to get an undergrad early in their career who has no skills at all, except for a willingness to learn and to show up on time and to communicate. And those things, you know, go a really long way. And just again, being curious. And I would rather have someone arrive with no skills at all and have that, that willingness to learn. I can highlight this. There's a comment, Thomas says, Edgar, I think you have great perspective. I had a similar approach in many years ago to my engineering career and it worked well for me. Awesome. Thank you so much. and there are many challenges along the way, but building these experiences and also, you know, by volunteering, he's volunteering on our committee. So this is also something to add to the resume. Okay, so next we're gonna hear from current ESS graduate student and member of the ESS DEI committee, Gemma O'Connor. And before I do, I just wanna mention, you can check out the chat for another couple comments. Bruce Nelson says, thanks for reframing what networking means. It's fundamentally about following your curiosity. And Kathy Troost suggests that the UW Career Center has great resources for help with that networking. Thank you so much. Okay, so on to Gemma, who also serves on our DEI committee.
Thanks, Kate. Hi, everyone. So I first got into research when I was an undergrad at Georgia Tech, where I was studying industrial engineering, which is a kind of funny coincidence given what Edgar just said. But anyway, right before my senior year of college, my trajectory completely changed when I took a random class in the earth science department at Georgia Tech, where I met the professor whose lab I joined, and I joined it for kind of nonsensical, whimsical reasons. But during class one day, she announced that she needed an undergrad lab assistant. And I just really liked her as a professor and I needed some extra money and it was a paid position. So even though it was super unrelated to what I was studying, I decided to join. And I didn't really know all the benefits that I was signing up for when I joined. But I actually really loved the work when I joined. I loved working with the lab group, which was an incredibly diverse and welcoming group. I loved doing lab work, even though it was tedious at times, it was something valuable that I could contribute to the science that I didn't need prior experience for. And it was a really nice break from my typical computer work. So on the bottom right is a picture of the instrument that I used. We have a similar one here in ESS in IsoLab, and I was using it to measure oxygen isotopes in corals to study climate change. So I just thought it was a super fulfilling thing to study after studying industrial engineering. I also got a chance to do fieldwork on a beautiful island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And these experiences made me realize that I did want to go to grad school, which I never thought I wanted to do because I wanted to make decent money after school and I was sick of school. I guess my point is you never know what your passion is or even what opportunities exist until you just try a bunch of different things. And my undergrad experience led me here where I'm super excited about what I work on. I'm still studying climate change, but now I have a glaciology focus. And I actually feel more financially stable than I thought I could be as a grad student. So that's something that I didn't really understand before. So I would encourage people who previously hadn't thought about trying research just to try it and see what happens. Even if you don't end up in grad school, there are so many benefits. And I think the biggest one of that was mentorship, which I didn't receive much of as an undergrad. So there's not much to lose in just trying it, but a lot to gain.
Thanks so much, Gemma. I like this a lot because you're sort of talking around a lot of the issues that are real concerns to our undergraduates, and I know to many of our panelists and people who are here, the idea that you have to work, we're working our ways through school. It's an enormous sacrifice to go and get your education in so many ways, and it's a huge commitment. And so to realize that you can get paid to get research experience, even if it's not exactly in a field you saw yourself in, this is still interesting and can be part and have a lot of wide-ranging benefits you might not have predicted. And there are a lot of great labs that do a great job of making you feel included. And so it's nice to highlight all these benefits. Kathy Troost is also saying, everyone loves to help students, so that also helps take the pressure off when reaching out to people. And I hope you really agree with this, like we feel special, like someone thought what we do is interesting enough to reach out about. So we do love to hear about students. There's so many emails that you don't want to get all day. And the ones we love to get are the ones where students say, hey, I think what you do is interesting. Can I join you? So thank you for that. Next, we're going to hear from Surabhi Biyani, current undergraduate student in ESS and atmospheric sciences.
Hi, I'm Surabhi Biyani. I'm a senior in ESS and atmos, and I've had opportunities to do research in both of these departments. My first project was in ESS, and I found it just by talking to my professor after class. I'd taken an intro glaciology class with Ed Waddington, and I was telling him that I was interested in glaciology, and he let me know that there was a summer research position available in the glaciology group, and that's how I ended up working with TJ Fudge. This was my freshman year. I didn't realize research was an opportunity for me. I didn't plan on it. In fact, I had a summer camp counselor job lined up for that summer. But this was a funded research opportunity and it sounded cool. So I started and I worked with TJ for the whole year basically. And we were able to publish a paper and I took the project to AGU. So that was, a really cool, great opportunity that made me interested in research. And then after that, I'm also an Atmos major. So I was talking to my Atmos advisor about climate research. And she connected me to Dargan Frierson, and I ended up working with him for a summer too. Both of those projects were through the Washington NASA Space Grant summer research program. So they were funded, and I learned a lot about just presentation skills through that also. And then finally, I applied for the Noah Hollings program, which was another scholarship and internship opportunity. So I've worked with a GFDL scientist now. I guess my biggest takeaway is just talk to people about things you're interested in, and you never know what opportunities people have or what they know about.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Serbi. I love that you've highlighted ways to sort of be proactive about finding scholarships and things. And so not only do these experiences help build your resumes to get more scholarships or to get future job opportunities, but they are also sort of ways of plugging into different scholarships and fellowships and programs that you wouldn't otherwise hear about or have access to. And I also love that you've highlighted, it's just about, you know, talking with people about your being curious and talk and sharing, you know, sort of exploring your interests with other people. And that is pretty impressive to go have gone to a national, an international conference to present your research so early on in your career. So that's a really great kudos. Next, we'll hear from Kalpana Prasad, who earned her BS in our department in 2019 and is currently a master's student in our department's Applied Geology program, looking for a career in environmental and geotechnical consulting.
Hi, everyone.
Can you unmute?
Oh, sorry about that. I'm on my phone. Hi, everyone. So I'm just going to go over my trajectory for my research and some of my experiences, especially in GeoClub. I was an undergrad and I came in knowing I wanted to do geology and knowing that I wanted to research, but I didn't really know where to look. And I ended up finally finding GeoClub, which is the undergrad interest group. And from there, I was able to find some awesome field experiences. I got to see the sunset on Mauna Kea and explore Southern California. And eventually I ended up on a field trip with Bruce Nelson to the San Juan Islands, where I found my research opportunity. And so from that, I was able to apply for funding from the Mary Gates Scholarship. And I presented my results at a symposium. And I currently still work at the Isotope Geochemistry Lab. And so I kind of just want to point out that basically, don't get stuck looking for the perfect project. I had this thought when I was an undergrad that I had to find a project that I knew everything about and that was exactly what I was going to spend the rest of my career doing. But that is not true at all. You can kind of flail around and figure it out as you go. Do whatever looks interesting for you. You can change. I am currently now in the Applied Geology Department, and I'm trying to combine my interest in environmental science and geochemistry. And it's been amazing. And I just don't get stuck on one thing and don't get stuck looking for the perfect project. I also had some experiences with the student ambassador for the College of the Environment. And I was in GeoClub. So if you have any questions about that, feel free to reach out to me. Thank you.
Awesome. I'm going to keep it moving along so we have our time to hear from our final panelists, who's going to share perspective from Natalie Wisdom, who graduated with departmental honors and a minor in environmental studies in 2019 and currently works for Apple. Here you go. Oops. Natalie.
Hi, thanks, Kate. Sound check. Is my audio working? I have a lot of issues with it. Okay, cool. All right, so I'll start with research and jobs. So I heard about undergraduate research from friends who did the honors program, and then when I joined the honors program, where it is required to do so, I was like a pinball bouncing around Johnson Hall trying to find a research opportunity until I was eventually directed to Allison Duvall. I got valuable experience studying, mapping, and analyzing data with GIS. My project was a case study in Loma Prieta focusing on the relationship between earthquakes and cliff seismic landslides. It made me a unique applicant, and I used it to get my internship in remote sensing and my current job as a GIS technician contractor at Apple, where I analyze spatial data. It's not geology, but I am still learning hard and soft skills that I can apply to a geology job. Feel free to contact me later if you want to know more information about the GIS contractor life, because there's a lot more to that. As for personal experience and diversity, we all know what the stereotypical geologist looks like. The ESS department lacks BIPOC and other diversity, and it can be hard to feel a sense of belonging when your role models are limited. And as a mixed Black woman with a speaking disability, I felt strong imposter syndrome throughout my academic career in geology. I joined the major and the honors program pretty late because of it, but I'm glad I eventually did. So you may feel alienated for any other reason, but if you enjoy geology or any scientific field, don't let your imposter syndrome stop you from following your passion or partaking in research. In ESS, it can be hard to find, but I encourage you to make it a priority. I'm so glad I did. Thanks.
Thank you, Natalie. That is so moving and important for all of us to hear. And I'm just thrilled that you are one of the role models that all of us have to look up to right now. Thank you. So with that, I want to circle back to our main message for today, that we've heard about opportunities and their benefits and their challenges. And it's wonderful to hear the ways many students and mentors are having great experiences, but still many students are excluded from these opportunities because of systemic biases and discrimination, and also express frustration that they feel like they don't belong and they don't know that sort of secret handshake needed to access opportunities. And many individual mentors are doing a great job of being inclusive, but it's clear that as a unit and as the earth and space sciences scientists in general, we need to be more intentional about how undergrads are recruited and mentored in our department and in our profession. And so what I wanna share is our message for faculty, staff, and other potential mentors who are watching this, that grappling with systemic discrimination and bias in geosciences and earth and space sciences can feel just completely overwhelming to the point that one could feel powerless to help. But in reality, faculty, principal investigators, and other scientists in these leadership and advising roles actually do have great power to make a difference in the environments that we oversee. And there's no need to reinvent the wheel here to figure out what to do. For example, this recent article in AGU Advances that I'm highlighting on this slide identifies how scientists in these roles can immediately address bias in the lab, in the field, and in classrooms to make a difference right now, while important but comparatively slower institutional changes go forward. And so we'll send out this PDF of this article with our follow-up information about this event. And also there are additional links to resources for mentors and students in the resources slide at the end of the slide deck that we've also shared the link with you. Okay, so on to your thoughts and questions is what we'll talk about next. And although we only have a handful of minutes left before 2 o'clock, our panelists, most of them have generously agreed to stick around for discussion if there are students present who want to ask questions. And also Chris will be posting in the chat a link to a survey where you can post additional questions if you don't get time to ask them here. And just quickly, the link to the article that I shared is in the chat now. Okay, so we'll see if this works. Let's see if the poll turns it on. Okay, it's activated. Okay, so what questions, comments, and thoughts do you have? Students, you can just type your questions, and everybody else, if you want to identify sort of what role you play, feel free to add it. People are also welcome to type, raise your hand in the, by typing stack into the chat if you want Chris to call on you, or just by typing your questions as well, and we can read them out loud for you.
Yeah, we already have. Owen Callahan had a question. Owen, do you want to ask that yourself, or do you want me to read what you sent me? He has a leaf blower behind him. So why don't I read what he sent me? His question was, what do faculty consider when screening more than one candidate for only one position?
Does anyone on the panel want to respond to that first?
I think as far as the PNSN is concerned, it kind of depends on the position. And as I tried to illustrate, we have kind of a whole range of positions doing a number of different types of things. And so if it's a programming position, we're going to kind of break it down to who kind of fits. But we also do interviews, and those interviews really strongly direct where we go. It's our network is all about rapport in a lot of ways. So we really like to kind of see how you interact with us. And we get that everybody is kind of nervous on an interview, but we try to keep that rapport in mind, at least through the interviewing process. So it's kind of a balance of a number of different things, including experiences, as well as just how things kind of fit in terms of personalities. But we definitely need to be more mindful, I think, as everybody does, of, you know, the facts that we can come in with biases, and that we need to kind of readdress them as we are evaluating candidates after the fact.
Can I add, so this is Renata, and I also work at the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network. That one thing that also helps is if you're a little bit earlier in your undergrad career, because we like people to stay on long. And I think I heard one of the faculty members say something similar, that it's really nice if you have an undergrad that you hire that can stick around for a while. And also if they're willing to stay on through the summer, and usually you can work more hours than during the summer. But that's often, if you know, we have two candidates and they're both great, but one has a lot more time left, then often that can actually work in their favor. So,
if I can just mention that also, we heard so many of the students who commented that they asked one person and they didn't have an opportunity, or maybe they didn't have room and they connected them with someone else. So please apply anyway, and don't worry about it, because we're all interested in finding new connections. Let me read some of the other anonymously posted comments. One was, I've tried to find positions in the past, but need to have a paid position. Why are some positions unpaid and others aren't? Does anyone on the panel, or just any of the faculty or staff who offer these positions, want to weigh in?
Here's Renata again. I don't know what to format. I think some of it might be if we just want to assign you tasks, and have complete control over what you're doing, then it would be more likely to be a paid position. Whereas if it feels like this is really an opportunity to do some original research where the person is really learning and enriching their skill, and kind of, then it might be more like a volunteer, like it's great you're doing this research, but I guess the bottom line is, what value are we getting out of the work? Is it really helping us do our mission? Then we'll more likely to pay for it. Or is it more an enrichment for the student, and then it's more likely to be volunteer?
So Kate,
Juliet also had a comment, and this, I think Renate's point really brings up an equity issue. Yes. That some people have the luxury of being able to do activities without being paid, but that is a luxury, and it's a privilege, and it's something that definitely has a lot of complexity with it. Juliet had
that's a good point. Bruce?
Okay,
I'll great. Defer to Bruce, because I suspect we're on the same page.
I think we're on the same. That is definitely an equity issue. And what I would suggest is, none of these are necessarily constrained zero-sum games. That if you are interested in something, working in a lab, and it is for your enrichment, and it's not to wash beakers at a certain, you know, number of dollars per hour, ask the mentor and ask the chair of the department. There is funding that we should be able to use to resolve these equity issues. So what I think we should untangle a little bit here is, there's two kinds of undergraduate experiences. There's the one where there's a project or a grant that has written into it, we're going to pay someone $17 an hour to do this task. Okay, that's one kind of graduate experience. There's another kind where you and a researcher find some common interest and you both gin something up. That isn't paid, there isn't money for it, but work with the department. And I think it's possible I mean, I'm not going to speak for the chair, but I think it's possible to come up with that sort of funding. This also applies to a question that the first question that was asked. If you have one position and two people applying, who do you choose? In some situations, it could be that, well, hey, we've got two good people. Let's make up another position. There's always a lot to do, okay? And that's another time where you may go to the department and the faculty member or the researcher might say, hey, chair, I'll split this with you. So there are a lot of possibilities, and ask the mentor to be a little bit creative about it.
To build on this, just to acknowledge some things in the chat, people are saying things like you can offer opportunities for paid hourly, that can be through work study, or that can be at a full rate. It can be finagled in lots of different ways. Many of the scholarships and programs that are around the university are sort of one-offs that a faculty member or a student applies for, and they can leverage those funds. Often there's matching involved. You can always ask the chair, people are putting resources in the chat that you should take a look at as well. And also note that you can ask for college credit for this. So this is credit hours. Sometimes you just need one more credit hour to round out what you're supposed to do for that quarter. That's how we got a wonderful lab member to join us last fall. It sort of said, hey, do you want to, Daniel Lopez, do you want to join us sometime, anytime you want to? And then finally we came around to a quarter where he needed one credit hour. We're like, this is it. And he did amazing. And so he then got a paid position the next quarter, and now he's graduated and working in the lab. So there are lots of different ways. If you have to sign out, please do. Many of us are going to stick around and continue to answer questions, and this will be posted. And there'll also be that questionnaire that we'll send out. So if we'll have more questions that you want to ask, we can post it in what we'll find a format where we can share all this with you, as well as an email template so that you can feel confident reaching out to people in a professional way. In case people have to sign off, I just want to thank our panelists one more time and all of you for participating and joining us. Thank you. Okay, so to answer, ask a few more questions. Did anyone have any?
One last note to that topic. I would say that finding the opportunities to get students pay is definitely on the burden of the faculty or staff as well. So students shouldn't, and I'm speaking to the students directly, you guys shouldn't feel like it's your burden to try to find a way to make money. If you're doing work for somebody, just make sure to say, hey, is there a way for me to get money? And then it should be on that person to find the ways.
That's a great point. And I'd actually like to take it further. And I'd like to explore ways of having the department. I noticed a comment in the chat that Oceanography is now trying to do this equitably and fund everyone. And I would like to maybe work together with our colleagues to come up with a policy so it's very transparent, like our principal is this, we should offer funding, here are the ways that we will find to do it, and or credit hours. And this should not be the limiting factor. Some sort of a holistic way so that the burden is elevated and that it becomes more of a system thing where we can avoid these equity issues and having it all be on the burden of the people who are sort of at the bottom trying to get this. So there were questions about resources for getting research support from the department, college, and university. There are a whole bunch of those that the College of the Environment, I think, has a bunch posted on their website, but we can also help compile these resources or point you to them. There's a question about the ESS lab tour seminars. When will this begin again? And if so, that should be strongly advertised to first year, second year, and new ESS students.
I can comment on the lab tours. That course is not currently being offered because we don't have an instructor for it. And it had been run sort of in concert between Student Services and Geo Club. But it's been put on pause for, you know, related to some of these themes that we're discussing, like making sure that folks are being compensated fairly for the work that they're doing, and so making sure that we're being responsible as a department about our relationship with Geo Club and the kinds of responsibilities that we're asking them to take on for the department. So this is something that we have been sort of discussing here and there for post-COVID context of how can we continue the spirit of this sort of lab tours as a way to get our majors connected in with the department and all the different labs. And there's another course that we're looking at offering next year that would be much more about how to be an ESS student, opportunities in ESS, about the department and how to get involved, and less like not a science lab course, where we could integrate some of these things. And so stay tuned. I'm sorry that we don't currently have the opportunity available, but we are trying to sort of bring that back.
And Madeline had I think had a hand raised earlier. It's hard for me to see the hands raised, so please help me with that. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, I was wondering, does the undergraduate research office, is that a good source of funding for students at UW, or has anyone ever gone through them to get funding?
I'm not familiar with that.
I can, sorry. It is a good source of funding, but it is a competitive and sort of involved application process. So it's not something that's available all year round. It's something that you have to kind of think about when the deadlines are and give yourself enough time to put together a competitive packet for it.
Awesome. I have some more questions here that were submitted via the poll. Let's see. Just a comment. I felt I was at a disadvantage coming in as a transfer student with little connection to faculty, the department, and only a few quarters to get involved in a lab. It'd be great if there was some sort of ESS transfer student faculty networking panel. I think that's a fabulous idea. And hopefully all of this is being recorded. So ideas like that are things that we, this is really important to follow up on, and things that will be resources for folks in the past. Because if we have an event like we're having today, this can turn into a Q&A on our website. It can turn into the package of resources that'll help lots of people. So keep those ideas coming. And just by the way, you know, we have such fabulous resources in you, our transfer students. You come in with amazing experience and with a real drive, and you know what you want to do. So you are wonderful people to work in all of these opportunities. And we want to make sure those connections happen to you. Another question, a professor mentioned how most students from their lab took his class. Do other professors advertise open opportunities that they have in their class, and can that become a more normal practice?
So I'll jump in here. I teach geobiology in the fall, 313, and I pretty regularly advertise for opportunities in that class and ask for applications. And every year there's at least a little bit of interest. So I found it to be a really helpful way to try and find some undergrads who are looking for research.
Thank you. And I like this question because it also is, again, sort of thinking, how do we more normalize things so that the people who have opportunities know how to find folks? Because like the people we solicited to share their email addresses or whatever with us, they were all, oh my gosh, I have these opportunities and I'm having trouble finding people. Like if you aren't teaching a big undergrad class that year, you might have trouble finding people. So these are great questions that will help. There's another question here. Why are TA squared positions not paid, even with credit compensation? That credit does not do anything to benefit the student. And
I can answer that also. So the TA squared positions, the terminology around that is actually part of an old program from around 10 years ago. Right now, what we have is for students to register for our ESS 492 course. And that is, it is a practicum in education, but it is also a seminar. So it is meant to be an educational opportunity and not, you know, that has a practical element to it, but it's not a TA, it's not meant to be a TA position. And so we sort of have been working really hard as a department to reform these opportunities in a way that is most prudent towards all of our constituencies and making sure that we're working well with our undergraduate students and providing them opportunities and also working within the bounds of our agreement with our academic student employees through the ASE union. So the TA squared, it's an old terminology that people still use, but it's not really accurate anymore. And that would actually be enrollment in a seminar course for practical practicum and seminar opportunities.
Thanks. Another question here, what options are recommended to students who graduate this year but don't get into grad school this fall? I don't know if anybody have suggestions.
Kate, I could say one thing. Even though I earlier spoke about how competitive the job market is, it's also a lot of companies are looking to hire now. And so if you don't get into grad school and you want to do something, you might consider working for a summer or a year and maybe get into grad school the following year, because there are just a lot of potential jobs out there in more the applied realm.
Also, I think you should contact the professor who are interested to see if they have any funding to support you. I remember Bruce has done this multiple times for students, and I did this once, I think. So you should talk to a professor. They may have some funding to support you for at least a year. So that can bridge the gap for you before you go to graduate school like next year.
I actually did that in a way. I ended up wanting to take a year off between grad school, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And I was able to continue working at the Isotope Geochemistry Lab for a year. So if you have any questions about that, you can reach out to me as well.
Awesome. There are some more questions here.
There's a question here in the chat.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Does the department have a transfer student advisor?
No, transfer students are welcome to see ESS advising. So that's myself, Noel Bernard Kingsley, and also our interim undergraduate advisor, Melissa Pritchard. So we have both worked with undergrads and worked extensively with transfer students and so newly transferred into ESS, but also students who are sort of pre-transfer. We work with students who are currently at other institutions who are planning their transfer to ESS. So we love to work with and welcome transfer students to the university, to ESS. So please, please do connect with us. We would love that.
Looks like there's also a comment from Natalie in the chat that her GIS job is designed to give people entry-level and temporary experience and plans to go to grad school in the future. And Melissa Pritchard, one of our advising team, says, I'm myself a transfer student, love working with transfer students. Hooray. So a couple more questions in here. In the sake of transparency, is there a timeline that faculty should consider about posting and hiring? For example, students are probably coordinating financial aid or jobs at certain times, like prior to starting the quarter, and will lose flexibility at some point. And does anyone have thoughts on this as we think as a department, how to sort of coordinate things better to be easier for students?
Can I echo that point a little bit more by saying that oftentimes mentors don't know or don't have an opportunity advertised per se. They just know that they're willing to accept students. And oftentimes students don't know what they want to do. They just may know that they need experience, or somebody suggested that they should get experience. And so those two things are a barrier, and going up to somebody at random or somebody that you have a class with and just saying, I know I need experience, I'm not quite sure what it is, do you have any opportunities? The answer may be yes, not because they had something advertised, but because they know that this is coming and it comes every year. And I also would like to see an organized effort every year by our department to kind of advertise like, hey, we do this, we know it's coming, please come talk with us.
I saw Feng Zhen smiling there. I don't know if you have a comment you want to add.
No, I totally agree with Andy. I totally agree with her. That's why.
Great. This actually dovetails well with the next question. Do professors have any helpful tips for asking for recommendation letters or the time frame they're willing to write them in, like a year or two after graduation? This is another reason why getting involved with these activities, whether it's through volunteer service on a committee or growing that. And whenever I say the word service, I attach the word leadership, because serving on a committee is service leadership, and on your resume, you put it under leadership. but those are the people who you're trying to build that, you know, that network with, to have people available to serve as your references for a job or to write you letters. Do any professors have tips for asking for those letters?
Let me jump in here. I typically tell my class, you know, when you're asking for a letter of recommendation, what you want is a strong, positive letter of recommendation. You don't want just a letter of recommendation. You want a strong, positive letter. So ask specifically for that, because you don't know, like maybe a faculty person isn't comfortable writing that strong, positive letter, and they write you kind of a so-so letter. You don't want that letter, right? So, you know, really developing relationships with people who can write you letters so they can say something personal about you and really mean it. That's important. And that comes through in letters. And make sure you're always asking for a strong positive letter, because that's ultimately what you want.
Yeah, I wanted to emphasize exactly the same thing. And what I will add is, to develop that relationship, you actually need to be thinking about your letters of reference 1 to 2 years before you're going to ask for them, because every letter of reference is going to have something about your class, your grades, the sort of standard stuff. What sets one letter apart from the other is just exactly that kind of interaction that Drew was talking about. What do you know about the person's leadership? What do you know about the person's drive? What kind of conversations, interactions have you had with them outside of the class, in research, and anything else? And that just doesn't happen a month or two before you need to ask for the letters of reference. So long-term strategy in a sense, developing your reference letter writers a year out is really, really valuable. And I tell you, the best letters any of us will write are the ones where we've got a lot of information to share. Those are going to be good letters. It's really hard to write letters where all I know is your grades and your transcript. That's really hard.
I love that point, both of those points, because your job as a student, you are the best advocate for what makes you special and right for this job, this grad school opportunity, this internship. You are your best advocate, and you know those details. And so even just having worked on 3 reference level letters last night alone, let me tell you that what's super helpful to me is when people ask, I always write back something like, okay, send me the name of this opportunity, who I'm addressing the letter to, and the due date. And then send me a bullet point on how I know you and in what capacity and for how long, because that's, they always ask that. Then highlight things like, remind me of special things you did in my class, like you always chatted at the front of the room, or you asked questions, or you went on that optional field trip, or you volunteered for this thing, or you organized a study group. Then you talk about your greatest strengths, and I ask people to do shameless bragging. I'm like, it's gonna feel ridiculous, but write that you how what you're wonderful about and in these areas, about your personal skills, about your academic strengths, about your experience, et cetera. And I always tell people, don't worry, I'll change the phrasing if it sounds, you know, over the top. I have never gotten the shameless bragging from a student that was over the top. And I've often had to embellish more, right? And then the final thing I always ask for is an example of a challenge you've overcome. And then also anything else you want these people to know. And those are sometimes things that you don't feel comfortable sharing about yourself, but as an employer, as a future mentor, those are 2 of the most important things for me. I care less about your accomplishments than I care less about where you are than the journey it took to get there, because that journey and what you've overcome and your resilience are what predict for me how well you're going to stick to it when the going gets tough. So those are things that help me as a letter writer, and you should feel completely empowered to provide those things. Some people, very few, but a handful of people know or have like Googled it somewhere and knew to provide me those bullet points up front, but I also just have the standard email I send back. And this is bringing up the idea that in our package of information here, one thing we should include is these bits of advice from Drew and Bruce, and maybe the list of the things that those of us who write these letters dozens a year like to have is that information, so we can write that, like Drew says, that really strong positive letter.
Kate, could I add one thing to your list? And it may be obvious, but it doesn't always happen. Also, along with the things that Kate asked for, send whatever essay statement that you have to provide the employer. Because it's not just about letters for grad school. It can be letters for internships. And those internships might be at a park. It might be at a private company, or it's job letters. And the way we write our letter needs to be well aligned with what you are applying to. And that's one of the best ways for us to make sure that, you know, the employer is looking at your statement and my letter saying, oh yeah, those two things are reinforcing each other. So that would be something else to add to the list that you provide to your letter writer.
I think we should crowdsource it and have all the faculty put in their and staff who write letters all the time put in their tips. So just to piggyback on that quickly, as I'm looking at time, because all the faculty have to go to a faculty meeting in a few minutes, and many of you other have places to be. One person notes that it's difficult to get recommendation letters early, like when you're, you know, as a sophomore, when you're a second year student, when you're trying to apply for certain research opportunities, because you don't know professors yet. So what are the ways, like Bruce says, you should start a year or two early in cultivating these relationships? What are ways to work on professor-student interactions earlier?
So I would say that one way is to try to find sort of, I know personally Geo Club used to have professors come and talk about their research or do little field trips. And I know it's not really happening with the pandemic, but when times are a little bit normal, hopefully we'll be able to have that up again. And I remember I was able to meet some really interesting faculty and have discussions, and just having something outside of class or something like that could be a great way if you haven't taken a class with them yet. And if you've taken a class, then you should be able to just go up to them and maybe have a conversation after class. But yeah, I also faced that where as an undergrad, as a freshman, I took one geology class and I couldn't talk to anyone. And that one geology class was Terry Swanson. And I talked to him and I got to come on one of his field trips for his 400 level class. And so I think just talking to, even if you're not in their class, you can reach out to them. I think that's a great way to start.
Just a comment from the chat, Elizabeth Davis, who's a grad student, says there are also ways that she went through and during her break between undergrad and grad school, and people are welcome to reach out to her for to talk about those things. Kathy says other ways to get involved with faculty earlier is go on field trips, volunteer, and help with field work. And just to say that, you know, field work is awesome. We don't all do field work. We have a whole lot of other things. Let's just say I recruited my first master's student on my first day of teaching as a faculty member in this department. I had an eye on this person because I couldn't get the technology at the front of the room to work. And he just sort of quietly stood up. And this was a transfer student on his first day as well. He just sort of quietly stood up, walked to the front of the class and like fiddled with the thing and got it to work and just went and sat down. I was like, I need you to build my temperature sensors and go to the Andes with me in Argentina. And that's what happened. So, you know, you don't have to have and many of us have all sorts of responsibilities outside of school. So we may not have the flexibility to go on field trips like we, or other things, or we have other issues of differences in ability and that can create barriers, although those are things we're trying to work on. So there are many ways that you can just show interest and curiosity and knock on the door. I have in the past taught a little workshop collaboration with Geo Club called How to Talk to a Professor. And it's literally like, how do you knock on somebody's door and what would you say that would actually be of interest? That's a little bit artificial, but just always asking a question is a great way. And everybody loves to chat with you. You've heard us, professors talk so much, especially me. So we're like very interested in talking to you.
Gemma adds, go to office hours and increase your interactions with faculty.
We may not have gotten to all of the questions, but again, we'll report on these and try to have like a little FAQ document. And it may take us some time to compile all this stuff and try to put it together for you. But if you have the link to the survey after, if people think of questions they would like us to address, if you wouldn't mind, if that exists, if you wouldn't mind putting it in the chat. So there is going to be a form. If we don't have it now, we'll send it out later, that if you have other questions about this, we can answer.
Yeah, I think we'll be sending it out later.
Oh, okay. That sounds great. So anyway, I am so grateful to our community for stepping up and sharing your stories about both the good things, but also the challenges that we're bringing to light here. So we hope that just the act of having this conversation demystified the process a bit for you, and that it also sort of instilled in those of us who would be mentors sort of a resolve about things we can individually do right now. Again, check out that PDF and those tips we'll be sharing. And also what we could think about being more ambitious about and more systematic about doing collectively to work towards equity in these opportunities and demystify the process. There is not a secret handshake, but it, you know, we don't intend for that to be, but status quo, sort of business as usual, in fact, makes it feel that way. And that is in practice what it ends up happening. And so we hope this is a start. This is only the first conversation. This is a long road that we're committed to traveling together. So thank you all. I wanna thank our panelists, especially the students.
Thank you, everybody, for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the advice. It was very helpful. Take care.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks so much. Have a nice day.
Hi, Andy. Thanks for coming.
Of course. So good.
Good to see you.
Catch you later.